Let's take our Bibles this morning and turn to Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15. When I was here last, we looked at a later portion of the book of Exodus, but as I considered what I might bring this morning to encourage your hearts and to strengthen your hands in the labor of worshiping and leading or worshiping our God and worshiping our Savior and serving Him in this community, thought it would be good for us to take some time to look at this earlier section in the book of Exodus. I'm going to begin reading in Exodus chapter 15, beginning at verse 22. This is after the people have been delivered from captivity and have come through the Red Sea, and the Red Sea has swallowed up the Egyptian chariots, and they have sung the praises of God, and there's a hymn of Moses in the earlier part of this chapter, and now we read about the journey through the wilderness that is beginning. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he trusted them. And he said, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in His sight, and give ear to His commandments, and keep all His statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after the departure from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instructions." Now please drop down with me to verse 31 is where I want to continue. "And the house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers of honey. Then Moses said, 'This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omerful of it be kept throughout the generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And Moses said to Aaron, 'Take a jar and put an omerful of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept.' And the sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. Then all of the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?' But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, 'Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?' So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, 'What shall I do with this people? A little more and they will stone me.' Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people, and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" There are many sins that we find that we're guilty of as we consider our lives. There are some sins, though, which are more prevalent among the people of God and people in general than others. We think of the sin of anxiety, carnal anxiety, and how easily and frequently we find ourselves either suffering from anxiety or some other carnal expression of fear in our daily lives. Another one of those sins that I think we are very prone to and that I've seen in my own life and in the life of those whom I've shepherded and interacted with over the years is the sin of grumbling, complaining, murmuring, grumbling, all kinds of ways you could describe this sin. And sometimes it's the mild, I can't believe this, I don't need this in my life. And other times it's a more violent reaction of grumbling and reacting negatively against circumstances or people. Well, our Bibles, again, prove to be very helpful in addressing this sin as much as it does the sin of anxiety. In this particular section, we have four locations, three incidents, and three gracious provisions. We're going to look at what took place at Marah in chapter 15, and Elim, chapter 15, 27, the wilderness of Sin, chapter 16, and then Rephidim, which eventually became known as Massah and Meribah in chapter 17. We're going to face three different kinds of difficulties: bitter water, lack of food, and lack of water. Then we're going to see how those things are resolved. Sweet water will come from bitter, manna and quail will come from heaven, and water will come from a rock. Now I have three very simple headings that'll be the outline for both messages this morning and this evening. That is the first two headings this morning, the third one this evening. We're going to look at grumbling, grace, and wilderness. God's grumbling people is where I want to begin this morning. Now, it's somewhat surprising, isn't it, when you turn to this chapter and we know the history of what God has done through the 10 plagues in delivering the people of Israel from 400 years of slavery, an oppression which got more intense before it got better there in the early chapters of Exodus. The darkness that marked them, the oppression that marked their lives. And now he has delivered them with his mighty hand. He's brought them out of Egypt. He's brought them through the Red Sea. They've seen him destroy the chariots of Pharaoh. And now we read in chapter 15 and verse 22 that they went 3 days in the wilderness and the people grumbled. 3 days, just 3 days from the deliverance in the Red Sea, and they're grumbling. In chapter 16, in verse 1, approximately a month and a half from this time, we see again, here they are, grumbling there in the wilderness on the 15th day of the second month. Their harmonious praise and singing of the praises of God in that hymn that is recorded in chapter 15, and the women who sang a shortened version of it, a chorus, if you will, that has now become dissident. One man said, those who were once minstrels have become murmurers. Or we could say those who were once carolers have become complainers. And it hasn't taken very long for that to happen. And that's somewhat surprising as we read our Bibles. But let's look at why they grumbled as we look at the various locations and the various events that happened. First of all, they grumbled because they were disappointed. And this is at Mara, chapter 15, verses 22 to 26. They come, there's a present need that they have, they're thirsty. Obviously, when you're traveling, obviously all of us, just for life, we need water, and especially in this particular setting. It's been 3 days since the Red Sea. Their water supply is probably running low, but as they're traveling with 2 million people, it's a lot of water to have to carry, they need sources. They need to come across sources of water. And then they do come across a place where there is water, and they find that they're disappointed. And they grumble because they're disappointed. The water, we read in verse 24, is undrinkable. They say, "What shall we drink?" They can't drink the water. It was bitter. It was bitter. Now, whether that means bitter in terms of its taste, and it was hard water that had some sulfur in it that was nasty to try to drink, or whether it was actually non-potable or undrinkable, whether it was poisonous, the word can mean either. But the fact of the matter is they come across water that they can't even drink. So here it is, and they're completely disappointed. They thought the answer had arrived. They thought everything was looking better, and it turned out to be unusable. Now, obviously, their grumbling is more than just because they've had some disappointments here, because they've clearly forgotten the power of God, have they not? I mean, what was the first miracle that God did in order to deliver them from Egypt? He turned the water of the Nile into blood. He has power over water. He took the water of the Red Sea and made it do that which it doesn't naturally do. He had it stand up like walls on either side, and He delivered them through that. He has just brought them out of oppression, provided for them, delivered them, and brought them to this place. He has caused frogs, insects, rain, hail, darkness. Clearly, this God has control over nature. Clearly, this God has control over water. But all they see is bitter water. Their bitter disappointment keeps them from, or leads them to grumble. That's the first grumbling incident that we see. They grumbled because they were disappointed. But secondly, we see in this next incident in the wilderness of sin, that is in chapter 16, we see them grumbling because they are dissatisfied. They are dissatisfied. Very similar, but slightly different. Now there are new challenges. Previously it was bitter water. Now it's insufficient food and water. They haven't got what they want. They haven't got all that they think they need. There are new difficulties here, and their grumbling intensifies. Notice what it says in verse 2. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled. Where before it was just the generic, the people grumbled, which we could probably assume is still a wide number, it's the people. Yet here it's clearly articulated that it's spread, it's the whole congregation of the sons of Israel. And while before they grumbled at Moses, here they now grumble at Moses and at Aaron. They're continuing in their grumbling, and it's getting worse. And their grumbling here is, as I said, because they are dissatisfied with their present circumstances. Now notice, they're not about to die. Right? It's only been a month. They're not about to die. But they fear dying because they fear they don't have enough and they don't have all that they want to have. They're looking for food, they're looking for water, but notice particularly the focus on food. Notice how this dissatisfaction is identified in verse 3. The sons of Israel said to them, that is to Moses and Aaron, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." There's not enough here. We're not satisfied with what we have. We need more. So here's what's lead. This is how they're expressing their grumbling. We don't have enough. We're not satisfied. But notice what they do. Notice how they describe their slavery. Slavery is described as sitting next to pots of meat and lots of bread. Now, that's not generally how I describe slavery. That's not how I read the first chapters of Exodus. It wasn't like they had it real easy with the big smorgasbord every night to get, you know, whatever they wanted, all you could eat for a couple of shekels. Right? That wasn't what they were facing. They were slaves. They were abused. They were driven. Remember, it got worse. Go find your own straw and keep up your work. Their hours got longer. Their work became more difficult. So the fact of the matter was, it wasn't as though they had a lot back then. But again, this is so typical, isn't it? When people become dissatisfied with their present circumstances, when they're disappointed in their present circumstances, we tend to idealize the past, don't we? Oh, it was so much better in the good old days when we had this and we didn't have that. Oh, what we don't remember is how hard it was and the struggles that came with that. Oh, it was so much easier before we had all these roads and all this and we just lived on the farm. I've spent time on a farm. It ain't easy. And I've talked to my grandparents, and you've read the histories. Life was shorter, work was harder, days were longer, and food was oftentimes very scarce if the harvest didn't come in. And so the fact of the matter is, but that's what they're doing. They're idealizing, looking back, oh, wasn't it better back then? Because of their present dissatisfaction, they are grumbling at their circumstances. Their hunger pangs are worse in their estimation than the bonds of slavery. And again, is not this an example of their failure to see God in the daily, ordinary activities of life? He has provided for them. He has taken care of them on a daily basis. We'll come to that a little bit later. But the fact of the matter is, they come to another circumstance where they are dissatisfied with what they have, and they grumble. It's not what they think they deserve, what they think they need. So third, we see them grumbling not only because they are dissatisfied and disappointed. We come to the third point. They are grumbling because they're disillusioned and they're dismayed. They're disillusioned. That is, they had dreams of what the promised land was going to look like. They took those words that Moses had given to them and the description of a land flowing with milk and honey, and they dreamed of what that was going to be like. They dreamed of how soon they were going to get there. And when it didn't materialize the way that they had dreamed it would happen, the way they had hoped it would happen, when it didn't meet their expectations and their time frame, they became disillusioned. And that led to them grumbling. And we read of their grumbling there in chapter 17. We read that in verse 2, "Therefore the people quarreled with Moses." And again, it uses that word at the end of the sentence. "Why do you quarrel," Moses says, "with me?" They're continuing to grumble and they're quarreling. They are intensifying once again their grumbling spirit. Rather than mortifying it every time God provides for them, it seems that every circumstance that they come across only intensifies what's underneath. Remember, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so when we see their mouths speaking intensified grumblings, we can expect that what we're seeing is something of what's truly in their heart. Their quarreling now with Moses is actually an attack. It's a contending with. It's stronger than just the mouth. There's probably accusations. Well, there's clearly accusations against Moses here at this point as to what he is doing to them. They're afraid of death. From the present circumstances, with their thirst, they extrapolate from their present circumstances to the worst possibility. There's no hope in this at all, is there? There's no thought, well, maybe God will do it again. They don't do that. They look at their present circumstances. They get upset that they don't have immediately what they want. It hasn't happened on their time frame. They become disillusioned, and so they grumble and say, we're going to die. Worst case scenario. Oh, if I have to take the trash out one more time, I'm going to die. If I have to clean my room, I'm going to die. No, you're not going to die. Right? But this is what they do. They extrapolate. I'm going to miss out on everything fun. I'm not going to have any more delight. No, we do that, don't we? We've come to a circumstance. We find that our way that we thought things should go hasn't materialized. And so we grumble and we complain. And that's what they did. But now here they're complaining about death and they're fearful of death. And granted, these are very real circumstances. Let's not minimize. You know, you're in the wilderness, you need water. You got 2 million people and some of them children, you need food. Right? So these are not small things that they're facing and small difficulties which they're facing. Death is a real possibility when you've got that many people and you have to feed them all and find water for them all. But who is the one who oversees and has in the power of his hand and in the power of his word life and death? Who is the one who preserved the firstborn of Israel and killed the firstborn, executed the firstborn of every Egyptian house? Who was it that preserved 2 million people through the Red Sea while they walked on dry land and then wiped out the entire crack unit of charioteers in Pharaoh's army? Who was it that has in his hand the power of life and death? You see, they've forgotten again, haven't they? And that's really what it all comes down to. For notice that grumbling here is ultimately an expression of unbelief. Look at the very last part of the text here. They put the Lord to the test, chapter 17 and verse 2. And then we read in verse 17 that Moses named the place Massa and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, chapter 17, verse 7, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now, that is incredible unbelief at this point. Because that is unbelief in the face of all kinds of obvious external evidence. Remember what God said to Pharaoh over and over again and what he said to the people of Israel. I am going to deliver you by my mighty hand. Why? That they may know that I am Jehovah. He has delivered them, and then he has provided for them time and time again that they might know I am with you. The pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud is still there guiding them. It's not as though it went away. Is the Lord among us or not? Is an incredible statement of unbelief. You see what they have is they have blinders on and all they're looking at is their material present circumstances. They're disappointed, they're dissatisfied, they're disillusioned, and therefore they grumble because they're facing pain in life. Now one commentator said with kind of his tongue in his cheek, it's a good thing that this generation all died in the wilderness. Because then all the grumbling died with them, right? Never to show itself again. Would that that were the case. But we know the history of Israel, and we know our own history. And we know our own hearts and our own tendencies. Sadly, that is not true. This disposition to grumble still presents itself. The temptation to carnal grumbling and quarreling still presents itself to us on a regular basis. And we need to honestly examine our hearts. We need to honestly examine our lives in the light of the example of these people. Because that's why God gave us this passage. Paul says in Romans 15 and verse 4, whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, that through perseverance and encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. But turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I want you to see that what I'm doing here is not something novel. It fits in very well with what we just discussed in our Sunday school class of finding Christ in the gospel in the Old Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Now we read at the beginning of this chapter that Paul wants to instruct them. He doesn't want the people of Corinth to be ignorant about our fathers, that is, the Jewish forefathers. And in particular, this generation that we're looking at here in Exodus. For notice what he says, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And they all ate of the same spiritual food and drank of the same spiritual drink. I don't want to get into all that's being said there about Christ and Moses and such. But my point is, I want you to notice that he's talking about this generation. He says in verse 5 that not just this part of the generation, but also the ultimate wandering in the wilderness, this I call the wilderness journey, the wilderness wandering is yet to come, but he says, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. But then he goes on to describe why he's telling them this. Now these things happened as examples for us so that we would not crave evil things as they craved. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. That's chapter 32. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did. And this is Numbers, but a similar incident to what's happening here. And were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, Paul, why are you moralizing this way? Why are you doing this? Why are you telling us this? He tells us, verse 11. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instructions, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. In other words, we have the same temptation to be grumblers like they were, to be murmurers like they did. We need to examine ourselves in the light of the Scriptures and ask ourselves, do I need a fresh application of Paul's exhortations to do all things without grumbling and complaining? Now, this applies to all children, right? We have used this with our children many a time. We give the chores, we tell them what to do around the house, and when they do it with that spirit.
I got it. I'll vacuum.
And you go, no. That's not acceptable. That's not obedience, right? Obedience is do what I tell you to do and do it with a sweet heart, a cheerful heart. As a friend of mine says, to do it neatly, sweetly, and completely. That's obedience. And that's the kind of obedience that's here. That's the problem. They grumble. They complain. They say, I don't need this. We don't need this in our lives. Now, brethren, I come to this passage not because your pastor wrote to me on the side. You know, he sent out that email to all of you, and then he didn't write one to me on the side. Would you please deal with grumbling? There's none of that. I can't say ever found grumbling among you. That's not a characteristic. But you are at a time in the history of this church where there's been intensification of disappointments, where you might have thought we should be here at this point. I mean, look at the pastor God has given us. Look at the gifts that he has, the ability that he... Certainly, this is going to be a man who's going to draw a large crowd. And you say, well, Lord, we have done the way you have told us. We worship according to your word. We organize our life according to your word. We have sought to be a Bible-based, grace-focused, Christ-exalting congregation. And certainly we thought this was going to lead to incredible amounts of people banging on that door, filling this place, because we have done what you have called us to do. And I'm just a little bit disillusioned. It hasn't gone that way. And there's a danger. There's a danger of grumbling. Well, maybe Pastor Dunn really missed it. Maybe he was a little too strict on that Sabbath stuff. Maybe he was just a little bit too long in Genesis. Maybe he was just, and there's the tendency to grumble. Or maybe if everybody had jumped in and done their part, and everybody had been there when we had that evangelistic outreach, or then there's a real temptation, isn't there? Be careful, he who thinks he stands, lest he fall, pointing to this generation. We can be in danger of grumbling. We're on this same kind of wilderness journey. And we are oftentimes disappointed with the things that come to us in life. Our job doesn't meet up to our satisfaction. We don't have quite the amount of money in the bank that we had hoped that we would have. And then we have the tendency to do the same thing, don't we? Tend to idealize the past. Well, back then, when we did it this way, that was the time it was really blessed. That was, well, wait a minute, did you forget that we had 3 church discipline matters during that time? Oh, really? Did you recall that there was this particular person that you had a problem with in the church during that particular time? No, we forget all that. We idealize the past rather than just recognize God has brought us thus far. He has brought us here. He has shaped our circumstances. One of the statements, I've said this before, I may have said it here. I say it a lot because I keep trying to remind myself. Is there's a statement that we tend to say, which I think can be indicative of a grumbling spirit against God. I don't need this, is the statement. Right? It's when I sit down at my computer to do my sermon and I get the blue screen of death. I don't need this on Saturday night, I tell myself, right? Who decides what I need? Who decides when the water comes? Who decides when the results are going to be there? Who decides that? God decides that. Christ decides that. The one who is sitting at the right hand of God, pulling off the seals on the order of the world, and setting forth in providence all that is taking place. And he is the one who is ordering all things. He is the one who has decided that. And so we need to think accurately about ourselves and about our past. We need to be careful that we don't immediately run to the worst possible conclusion. Mm-hmm. Well, 3 people left. We're dying. Close the doors tomorrow. Wait a minute. We don't know what the Lord might do. You know, whenever you're reading the Old Testament and you see a barren women and old men, God's about to do something. Think about it. Right? It's not a time for despair. It's not a time for disillusionment. It's not a time for disappointment. It's certainly not a time for grumbling. And when we see those temptations at times like this, we need to think biblically about them. We need to know we must not come like these Israelites. Is the Lord among us or not? Yes, the Lord is among you, as he has promised, where two or three are gathered together. There he is in the midst. As I listened to you sing the praises of God, and I sought to enter into those words that we sang, we were offering praises to the living God, drawing near to him. And I trust that you understood and felt something of the reality, him drawing near to us and speaking to us as we sang to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. As the scriptures were read and the prayers were offered, God was drawing near, and his ear, as it were, was stretching forth to hear those prayers that we were offering. Brethren, the question isn't whether the Lord is among us or not. Our circumstances cannot tell us that. God has revealed that fact. I will never leave you nor forsake you. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And the one with all authority is the one who made that promise to be with us. So don't let that disappointment or that dissatisfaction. You know, I really am tired of these old hymns, like some of the better stuff. Back when I went in that church, man, we sang. No, wait a minute. Did you really? Was it full of biblical teaching? It really doesn't matter what they did back then. Question is, are we satisfied with what God has given us in biblically ordered worship now? Be content, knowing that God is behind everything. No trial, no trouble has come your way. Don't let the sun of tribulation dry up your fruit. Prove to be rich soil, seed in rich soil, and continue to sink your roots down into the truth. Be content with the everyday common means of grace. But let's move from these grumblers to God's gracious care. God's gracious care. Now, while I said earlier that the grumbling is pretty amazing, that within 3 days and a month and a half, they were already grumbling, and I thought that was pretty surprising, I found it even more surprising to see how God dealt with them. Because we read that this one who dealt with them is a warrior. That's what they sang back in chapter 15 in verse 3. Jehovah is a warrior. And warriors tend to go forth executing judgment. And so that's what you might expect. And there is a case in Numbers where he did come in judgment, and while they still had the quail in their mouths, the plague hit. But that isn't what we see here. So let's look at God's gracious care. Let's see how he deals with them during this time. Let's go back to Mara in chapter 15, verses 23 to 26, and see how God dealt with them there. Remember, they found the water was bitter. They were disappointed, and so they grumbled. And so what did God do? Well, God sent them a man of prayer. And Moses cried out to the Lord, verse 25, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. God sent them a man who was a man of prayer, who interceded on their behalf. He prayed. He prayed specifically about the bitter water, and God gave him, in answer to prayer, a way to reverse the bitterness of the water. Now, there's a whole lot of ink spilt on whether this was a miracle or whether this was natural. He saw some tree that has some natural ability to soak up salts or whatnot. It doesn't really matter. The point isn't even the miraculous work that's done here. The point is, God heard him pray. God heard Moses cry out to him and ask for an answer, a resolve, and God resolved the issue. God gave them water in answer to Moses' prayer. And this clearly is an example that we need to follow when we face the temptation of disappointment and are tempted to grumble. Rather than grumble, we need to take that need, and we need to go to God with that need and plead with God to meet that specific need. He doesn't say, build us a big house here. He just says, we've got bitter water we need to drink. And so God provides a way for that water to be taken care of. He answers that simple prayer. And he answers it with, I think, is some very simple, or at least very simply described. He shows him a tree and he throws the tree and it's done. Very simple methods for dealing with such disappointments. We need to go to God in prayer, and then we need to use those simple means that he gives us to answer some of these disappointments. Sometimes it's just the simple words of the person who's offended you coming to you and saying, I sinned against you. Will you forgive me? And it's that you say, Lord, I'm disappointed with my wife. I'm disappointed with my husband. I'm disappointed with the members of the church. I'm disappointed. They've sinned. There's a problem here. And we get grumbling and bitter in our hearts. And instead, we should go to God, Lord, help me to go to that person, open that person's eyes to see how they treated me so that we can resolve this. Brother, could you help me understand? And it's the simple things in answer to prayer that resolve the bitterness, that address that bitter feeling. Or it's that simple card that somebody sends. You pray in the midst of your bitterness and you're down and you're discouraged and you get that card from that brother or sister in the church. It just says, hey, I'm praying for you. Hope all's going well. I trust that the Lord will meet with you. Simple little ways of meeting the bitter circumstances of life. Those scriptures that come via somebody sending you an email or some little picture or text that says, here's a verse I was meditating on this morning. And the bitterness is resolved. The disappointment is addressed. Let us hear, this is how God dealt with them. He helped, he sent them somebody who prayed. And in prayer, a simple answer was given to address the bitter circumstances and to bring resolution. Secondly, God cares. God's care at Elim, chapter 15, verse 27. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. That seems like a kind of an interesting statement. It's just a, you know, it's just a travel log here. Why list this in the middle of no water, no food, not enough food and water, and no water? Why this little statement here of this place with 12 springs? Because this is the way God often provides. Just in the ordinary, normal path of life, everything's there. How many of you have ever gotten up in the morning and really earnestly prayed, give me some daily bread today, because you really felt like it wasn't going to be there? Well, I may pray it, but I know I'm going to go out there and in the refrigerator or in the pantry or in the cupboard. And if for some reason I feel like I've got to run out of the house or nothing strikes me, okay, I've got a few bucks, I go buy McDonald's, I go buy Burger King, I go buy Wendy's, I go buy Panera's, I'm going to get, it's of course I'm going to eat. It's there, right? And yet, that's no less the provision of God than this tree that gets thrown in the water to provide sweet water. And so in the midst of all this, he says, here's a great place. There's 12 springs of water. There were plenty of date palms for you to eat. And there it was, right in the path of life, right in the normal, ordinary course of life, exactly what you needed. God provided for them at Elim through the ordinary means, just like he provided for Elijah. Put him by the brook Kirith. Oh, we all think about the ravens, right? That's the cool part. He sent ravens to drop food. Wow, birds giving food to man. And, oh, wow, God really provided, right? Well, he also provided a brook. Just as much. And it was just a brook. It was there already when he got there. But it was no less from God than the other. And this is what we have in the middle of this. God taking care of his people in the middle of all of the circumstances. And had they just remembered this, they could have said, well, you know, the Lord provided something in the past. He can provide again. And then we come to Rephidim, where God provides not necessarily, the focus isn't on through prayer or through ordinary means, but the focus there is really on the abundance, the daily provision, and the grace. In chapter 16, we read of that amazing incident where God sends them bread from heaven. God sends them quail at evening. And here is this constant daily provision. God caring for them, providing for them, giving them on a daily basis exactly what they need, no more, no less, except on the sixth day of the week. And by the way, just so you didn't remember, Exodus 16 comes before Exodus 20. The Sabbath is already here. He doesn't explain, oh, by the way, we're going to hear about this at Mount Sinai where we're finally going to... No. The Sabbath already existed. Genesis chapter 2. And here we see it even before we get to Mount Sinai. But that being said, God provides for them and He gives them all that they need, more than they need, in abundance, meat and bread, night and morning. But now there's something I want you to see here, because again, I want us to see how amazing this is. Notice with me verses 6 and 7. We read there, Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, at evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. Now these words, these are the ones that stood out to me. He hears your grumblings against the Lord. Verse 8, Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening. There's the way the Lord is going to show that He brought them out, and they're going to see the glory in the morning. How's that going to be seen? Bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against Him. Again in verse 9, come near before the Lord, for He has heard your grumblings. God Himself says, verse 12, I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Now, as a son who knew what it was to have a father who dealt faithfully with my sin, my dad dealt very faithfully with my sin in the normal, ordinary, biblical means. There were times when I had trouble sitting down. I'll just put it that way. Right? If I heard these words from him, I heard you grumbling. I heard what you said to your mother. I heard what you said to your sister. That would not be a cheering comment. Right? That would not give me, oh, I'm so glad you heard that, Ted. And yet, several times in this passage we hear, God heard your grumblings. I heard your grumblings. You were grumbling against me. I heard it. And so what does he say? I'll give you meat. I'll give you bread. You'll see my glory. You'll know that I brought you out. Notice how that highlights their unbelief at the end. You will know that I brought you. Because he gave them daily manna. So when they grumble later on about not having water, it's in a context in which they're receiving daily manna from God. You see, they're denying the evidence of God's presence among them and God's working. But this is amazing. If it was amazing that they grumbled, I find it even more amazing that God is so gracious to them. I heard your grumblings, therefore I'm going to give you exactly what you asked and more. Now, why does God do that? Will He always do that? No. But He does it here to show His grace. God shows His grace to these grumbling people. And there's a sense in which that's actually designed to be far more convicting or a means of conviction. Paul picks up on this, doesn't he, in Romans chapter 2 and verse 4. Do you think lightly of the kindness and forbearance of God, which is to lead you to repentance? This was meant to convict them. Why are you grumbling when I am so gracious, when I so wonderfully provide for you? I've heard your grumblings. Here, eat. What an amazing God of grace. And then we have God's care for them in the wilderness of sin, where God provides powerfully and personally. That's in chapter 17. When God himself stands on the rock before them, Moses strikes the rock and out comes the water. And it's just again that display, that staff is the display of the power of God delegated to Moses, and he uses that again to show that God powerfully can provide for his family, for his people. Clearly, God is the one who provided. This isn't a natural event. This is a God supernaturally intrusion into their history. Sometimes that's how God deals with us, doesn't he? Sometimes he supernaturally turns over all of the horrible, terrible, difficult circumstances and provides. Well, brethren, in closing, as we've seen this grumbling people, and we've seen the amazing grace of God to them, and just say by way of application, when you're tempted to grumble, stop and think about all that God has already done for you. You know the chorus, right? Count your many blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what God has done. And then why do we grumble? He is the God who cares for his people. It talks about him in Deuteronomy when they come to the edge of the river and they're about ready to go in. And then in Nehemiah's day, they rehearse what God had done for 40 years, it says, he provided for them. I thought the wilderness was a time of chastisement. It was. But it was also a time for God to show his amazing grace and his amazing kindness to his people. That though one generation died, another generation was being tested and provided for. Listen to Nehemiah 9:21. 40 years you provided for them in the wilderness, and they were not in want. Their clothes did not wear out, nor did their feet swell. Have you ever walked on sand for a long period of time? And we're not talking about any kind of trains or, you know, this was walking through hot sand. Their feet didn't swell. I just came from the Philippines, and I noticed every night that every afternoon after I finished my lectures and I would go in to shower to cool off, that my ankles and my feet were a little bit bigger just from standing for 4 or 5 hours in the heat. This was a time when God was caring for them and watching over them. As our hymn says, hymn number 51, when all thy mercies, O my God, my rising soul surveys, transported with a view, I'm lost in wonder, love, and praise. Unnumbered comforts to my soul, your tender care bestowed, before my infant heart conceived, from whom those comforts flowed. 10,000 precious gifts my daily thanks employ, nor is the least a cheerful heart that tastes those gifts with joy. How many times has he met with us, provided for us on a daily basis, fed us from his word, that daily manna, to comfort and strengthen and encourage and keep us going to the next day. Daily met our physical needs, not to mention our spiritual needs, but our physical needs. He's been there meeting with us. How many times has he brought us through difficult circumstances, either by his grace that we might bear up under them, or by his power that he might alleviate them? How many times? Now, certainly grace is not a reason for complacency. We'll come to that this evening. It does put us in the place where we should not test him. but instead should lead us to repentance, lead us to obedience, encourage us to trust Him. Brethren, let's deal with the unbelief of our hearts. From what God has told us in His Word about who He is and how He provides, to what we see in our personal experience and what we have seen with one another, to trust Him to provide. And then I end with just one final comment. We'll come back to this as well. But isn't it interesting that in this small section, how many pictures of Jesus Christ there are? There's the intercessor who never grumbles about praying for His people. There's the manna that comes down from heaven, Jesus says was a picture of Him. The rock from which the living water flows, which Paul says was Christ. You see, we're on a wilderness journey. We're between redemption and the promised land. And between the two, it's a wilderness. But it's in that context that Christ most often reveals Himself as the one who provides for us. Just as He did here with all of these pictures of His wonderful provision, He has graciously and abundantly provided. And He who did not spare His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how will He not also with Him freely give us all things? Do we believe that or not? So, brethren, let's remember what it looks like and how sinful grumbling is. And let's remember how gracious our God is. He hasn't given us what we deserve, but He has in grace ministered to us and met with us time and time again. And trust Him as we make our way through the wilderness journey, that He will care for us. And more importantly, He will never leave us. May God encourage you and help you, even as you continue in your life as a church together. Let's come back this evening then and hear the rest of what we can learn from this section. Let's pray.